Welcome to Keeping Up with the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Abraham, for coming onto this podcast for the UMCT podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
For those listeners who don't know, Mr. Abraham is actually my senior buddy. You graduated in 2016, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Victor. That's correct. 2016, yes.
2016. Mr. Abraham is my ultra senior buddy.
Yep.
Can I call you Abraham?
Is that? Yeah, sure. Okay. Abraham, Abra, AB, anything.
Okay. So, Abraham, you are a constitutional lawyer. Would you brand yourself as that?
Well, I do quite a number of constitutional cases, constitutional and administrative law cases. I wouldn't call myself a constitutional expert or constitutional lawyer because that would suggest that I practice predominantly in the area of constitutional law. But I do have an avid interest in constitutional law, and therefore I think it's okay to call me a constitutional lawyer, but that's about it. I wouldn't say that I'm a constitutional expert or whatnot, lah. Yeah.
So like back,
practice quite a bit in constitutional law. Yeah.
So like I grew up with a lot of kids back in my hometown, and like none of the kids say like, oh, when I grow up, I want to be a constitutional lawyer. So like how did Abraham from primary school, from like, yeah, growing up, school guy, suddenly becoming a constitutional lawyer?
Well, I did not actually envisage that lah when I was in my childhood days and when I was in high school. No, I did not. All I wanted was to just be a lawyer, you know. And of course, I do have, aspirations or wanting to do the right thing. But of course, the concept of constitution and constitutionalism and practicing in constitutional law has not crossed my mind then. You know, I was only exposed when I actually did constitutional law in UM Law School. Yeah. So if you ask me how did I had that vision or that passion, it's actually a very gradual process. So I was, as we all are, I mean, exposed to constitutional law lectures and the syllabus, then we begin to understand, you know, how important constitutional law is, because that essentially is what is the grand leveler. It basically, it is above all things. So it is a subject of law which all other laws, as well as governmental actions, would have to then fall within that particular ambit and not be allowed to go in excess of what they are supposed to do or what they are being entrusted for. So that is why I feel that this is an area of law which is very interesting, and at the same time is the most important area of law, I would say, you know, in the governance of a country and the development of law as a whole. Yeah.
I like how you mentioned like doing the right thing, the personality of you, like attribute of you doing the right thing. Was that what led you to doing student activism, like being part of the student union in back in UM?
Yes, you see, the thing about doing the right thing is not actually subscribing to a particular idea, you know, or to say that, oh, you know, this particular way of doing things is the correct way. But it's actually to embrace a variety of ideas. And this is what we call academic freedom, like, you know, to basically to be able, as students and academicians, we are supposed to be able to think freely. And we are, and the most important and trait that I would say is very much lacking today is that we lack the ability to agree to disagree, you see. So that is what I feel, that doing the right thing doesn't just mean, you know, just following a particular standard or to subscribe to a certain viewpoint or to, ascribe to a particular discipline and say that, oh, no, this is what you should do. And doing the right thing basically means that to allow people to express themselves and to provide that particular forum, you know. We don't we don't shun people off. We don't say that, no, you're wrong and I'm right, you know. And but of course, we have to ensure that whatever we do and whatever we say is in accordance with, you know, what we call a higher standard. Higher standard. I mean, if you do jurisprudence in third year, I'm sure that all of us will be exposed to, you know, what they call a grant norm. You know, a grant norm meaning a particular norm that is general in nature, but it is it governs law in general and describes what law is in the basic form, in the fundamental form. So basically, so long as we subscribe to certain fundamental values, yeah, and do not deviate from them, we should actually welcome a difference in terms of expressions and ideas. So this is what I feel that doing the right thing is.
Talking about your experiences, not say hosting, I mean, did you host or did you like run the protest for Dr. Azmi Sharon, showing your support for him?
Oh, okay, that's a long past. So when I was in a students' union, being elected as a representative of the law faculty to the UM Student Representative Council, we address different issues. We do not just address student welfare issues. We also did have the opportunity to comment and to make statements, to give statements in relation to national issues. So one of the issues at that point of time was when Dr. Asim Sharma was being charged under the Sedition Act for making a statement, for giving a legal opinion, in fact, or rather a legal comment as to what would be the status, right, of a particular, I think that time was, there was this infamous Kajang move, you know, infamous Kajang move. And what happened was that rather the Menteri Besar of Selangor still had the confidence of the majority of the state assembly. So I think, of course, that Dr. Azmi Sharon did say that, you know, should do the right thing and basically call for a vote in the assembly and not repeat what is said to be the wrong move during the Perak constitutional crisis in 2009, right? Where, you know, what happened was that there was a secret meeting and the Menteri Besar is being chosen through that meeting. So basically, he was just giving an legal opinion. You know, well, we can agree, you can disagree, you know. But it is wrong in my view, and in our real collective view, that to charge Dr. Azmi Sharon, because basically that would be an assault on academic freedom to express by an academician. And he was a professor, he was an associate professor at that point of time. So to do that is wrong, it's grossly wrong in our view. And we decided to march. Well, of course, we did petition for support and all the other things as well, but we decided to basically send a strong message to not just to the government, but also to the university administration, that we feel that the university management should stand up for their staff, right? So that essentially was what we did. And I co-organized together with several other student leaders for a walk to demand that the university management do something about, basically make a stand as to in protest of what the government was doing, which I thought, of course the government did not respond at that point of time, but eventually they dropped the charges, right? So that I would say is a win, you know, at the end of the day, and it did have a trickle down effect to the community as a whole, and also for the government to know that, you know, you can do whatever you want, you can go after the politicians, but don't mess with our, you know, academicians and our right of university students and university staff to exercise their academic freedom. Yeah. So that was one of the fond memories, I would say.
Abraham, were you not afraid?
Was I not afraid? Yeah, I was. I mean, you see, at that point of time, we were all under we were university students, and I was on a scholarship, right? So one of the conditions of my scholarship is that if I commit a university offense, right, it's not like a criminal offense, you know, where you get charged in a court of law. Even if you commit a university offense, regardless of how small it is, your scholarship will be revoked and basically penalties will be imposed, right? So I was very much afraid, you see. So, and I also get warnings and from my relatives, especially the ones who experienced Mei Tertin, who experienced Opera Si Lalang, you know. So they all of them told me, you know, you don't mess with this, we just live our lives. And I think that time was post the 2013 elections. So it was the BN administration. It was BN lost the 2/3 majority, and you know, they were clamping down on activists, on politicians, on opposition leaders. So at that point of time, there was like a chilling effect, lah. So people were telling me, no, you don't do that. You know, you just be a good student, go for exams, get your degree, you know, and that's about it.
Be quite quiet, keep quiet, don't tell anything.
But I just felt that, you know, that being a student, you know, where we basically were leeching off scholarships, we were leeching off taxpayers' money, public university. Well, the best we can do is to basically stand up for what is right and shun what is wrong, you see? And basically, we may be wrong, we may be grossly wrong, we may, 10 years down the road, we may feel, oh, why was I so stupid? Oh, you know, I was doing such a rash. But then that was kind of quite an experience for me, you see, to be able to join activism and to be able to embrace activism in that way. And also, some people will dislike you, some people will attack you, some people will disrespect you, but there will also be people who appreciate what you do. There will be people who basically say that, you know, thank you for what you have done and so far. So I wouldn't say that everyone should do it, you know, but if you are interested, I would encourage you to go for it, you know, to and it will be a fond memory at the end of the day, I must say. Yeah.
It'll make a good story.
Yeah.
So moving on to your professional career, one case I would like to highlight, help us highlight lah. Your case, it was you and Mr. Lim Wei Jia. You were defending 3 students for their freedom of speech and expression.
Okay. So that case was a judicial review application where 3 students, okay, what happened was that 3 students, they attended a forum organized by UM as well, if not mistaken, by the Ministry of Finance at that point of time, you know, in 2016. Yeah, in 2016, they had a forum in UM, I think in the Dewan Tunku Chancellor, where they invited Tunku Faizah, so who came and give a talk. Tunku Faizah, if not, Tunku Faizah and Arun Kanda, I think both of them, you know, Arun Kanda and Tunku Faizah, came and gave a talk on 1MDB, I think. So what happened was that 3 students then lifted, 4 students actually, 4 students lifted placards in protest of that, the attendance of Arun Kanda and also of Tunku Faizah. So basically they were saying that, you know, please return the people's money, some words lah, they were written on the placards. So of course they were stopped, their placards were snatched and torn, and they were then asked to leave lah, the forum. So after that, the university management, they pressed charges against the 4 students for disciplinary offenses. So then they were then found guilty lah, you know, disciplinary proceedings, a hearing was conducted, and they were found guilty for committing disciplinary offenses in very vague terms, you know, in like disrupting a university event and so forth, you see. So if you look at your UM rules, there will be many, many funny rules, you know, which are very vague, which you, basically anything you can do, you can actually get caught there. So they were caught. But then they asked for our help, like, you know, me and Wejet being alumni of UM. Yeah, and especially me having my own experience of being charged before.
you've been here before.
Yeah, I've been there before. I defended myself and I got off. So yes, maybe they saw some value in that. So then we filed a judicial review application against the University of Malaya, the disciplinary committee, and the appeals board for finding them guilty. So of course, in the course of the proceedings, we did raise many issues, including whether these rules are fair or not, right? Are actually fair in terms of the constitution to to restrict freedom of expression. So ultimately, the High Court in Kuala Lumpur allowed our application and quashed the convictions, right? And basically said that they did not commit any wrong. Of course, the court, in arriving at its decision, said that UM did not comply with certain procedures, right? And one important procedure is that it is almost like a criminal justice system where you first have to produce enough evidence to show that a prima facie case or prima facie offense has been committed before, then you can then invite them to call their own witnesses and defend themselves. So that was not allowed. That particular process was not allowed by UM. And the students were also not allowed to cross-examine the witnesses that were called by the university, right? So that was the procedural flaw that the court found, and ultimately the court allowed our application. But sadly speaking, I would say that the court did not address the issue on freedom of expression, right? Which I feel is important, but well, we live to fight another day. We just leave it for another case in the future.
So Malaysia is one of just 28 countries that still prevent women from passing their nationality to their children on equal basis with men. Why is that? Why so funny?
Okay, you see, I would say, this question is a bit tricky, because when you say that Malaysia do not allow, okay, it's the Malaysian government that does not allow, right? If you look at the federal constitution, what we have presented in court so far is that the constitution actually does not have an expressed provision which discriminates women. Essentially, what the constitution just says is that any person that is born outside the federation, we are talking about, you know, children that are born outside the federation, outside Malaysia, you know, to a Malaysian father, to a father whose parent, whose father is a Malaysian, the wording is that whose father is a Malaysian, is a citizen by operation of law. Okay. But at the same time, the constitution does not say that if the child's mother is a Malaysian, he is then not given. So essentially, it says that if the child's father is a Malaysian, he will be given citizenship. It did not say that if the child's mother is a Malaysian, regardless of that, he will not be given citizenship by operation of law. So we are saying that if you look at that provision, on the face of it, it's discriminatory. It basically imputes gender discrimination. But you can't just read that one clause in isolation. You must also read that with the constitution as a whole, which includes Article 8. And in 2001, the parliament actually moved an amendment to Article 8 to include gender as a basis that discrimination is not allowed or discrimination is prohibited, right? So that means there shall be no discrimination on the basis of gender. Okay, so on that basis, coming back to your question, it is the government's interpretation. What we have always been saying in court is that it's the government's interpretation of the law and the practice of the law that discriminates against women, right? And they then say that, okay, if your father is a Malaysian, you are given citizenship automatically. Usually it just takes like 3 to 5 days to process and they'll give the citizenship straight away. But if your mother is a Malaysian, your father is a foreigner, that means if the tables are turned, you know, then you have to fill up a different form. It's form F. If your father is a Malaysian, your mother is a foreigner, you fill up a different form, and it's form D. Okay? And then you have to go through a registration process under Article 15, which is entirely at the discretion of the government. The government decides whether to give you or not to give you. And there's only, based on our statistics, there's only a very, very small percentage of children born to Malaysian women overseas that have been given a citizenship by registration, not by operation of law, not automatic citizenship. So that is a problem. Of course, one might argue that it is up to Parliament to then, there's a lack of clarity to then amend the constitution to just say father or mother, you know. You don't have to leave it just father, you know, you can say father or mother or both parents, you know. You can basically amend and add these words, but regrettably, the Parliament has not done that. And recently, I think several members of Parliament have petition for private members bill. I think there were like 21 of them, if not mistaken. But of course, the Speaker of the House said that, you know, this deals with citizenship provisions. So under Article 159, it has to be referred to the Conference of Rulers. But our position that is to be taken is this, you see. The government cannot essentially ignore the plight. It's a real plight. You know, it's not something which, you know, women just, you know, want to be equal with men, and therefore, you know, just for that, the sake of equality on a very rhetoric basis. You see, it's not just that. It's basically the Malaysian mothers, they are suffering that plight. They want to raise the child in Malaysia, but their child is a foreigner. Unfortunately, many of them are divorced and separated from their husbands. But imagine you in one family unit, you are Malaysian, you live in Malaysia, you know, and you are going to raise your child in Malaysia. For some reason, you went overseas, you see. It could be a very sporadic or random reason. But, you know, when you came, Malaysia is your home, you know. So when she comes back and brings the child back, she wants the child to be educated, raised in Malaysia. But there's this great impediment. And what is very serious is during the COVID-19 close down that period of time where the borders are closed, essentially Malaysians are allowed to come back without impediment, but foreigners are not. You know, foreigners are not allowed to come in. So what happened is that there were instances where Malaysian mothers are actually separated from their children, right? And instances where they have to then renew their visas. So usually when the mother comes back, brings the child will be given a social visit pass, right? And every few months you have to go and renew your pass. That kind of inconvenience that they are actually facing. And there are also instances where in one family unit, one child is a Malaysian, one child is not. Just because so happened one of the child was born in Malaysia one time and the other child is born overseas. So we told the court that you must take cognizance of the plight, the reality of things. And when you read the constitution, there is no express prohibition. So if you look at the dissenting judgment of Nantabalan, Justice Nantabalan, you know, as opposed to the two majority judgments of the Court of Appeal, Justice Nantabalan basically says that if you want to create an exception to Article 8, that means you want to discriminate on the basis of gender, or on the basis of race, or on the basis of where you were born, you know, you have to make it expressed. In short, you have to say that, okay, I am now discriminating against you, or I am imposing positive discrimination, like Article 153, you see, for example. It is insufficient to basically imply something that would then derogate your right to Article 8. So that essentially is our case. We are saying that in the absence of express words, you then have to give the full breadth of rights, the full effect of the right to equality and equal treatment to Malaysian mothers, and that cannot be taken away. So the question of having to go through the go to the conference of rulers to amend the constitution does not arise, because we are not amending the constitution. We are just giving the constitution the interpretation that it deserves. You see, the constitution is not to be interpreted in a very rigid way or in a literal way where you just go by the letter of the law, you know, you just go by the natural meaning of the English language, or the dictionary meaning of the English language. You have to read it, and what we basically implore the court to consider is the organic theory of interpretation, which means that when you interpret it, you must interpret it like an organism, you know, like a living organism where it actually grows with time. So one might say that, you know, in the 1950s, when the constitution was first drafted, it represents a patriarchal society, you know, and therefore, in fact, what the government's lawyer said, that there was some sort of a sorting mechanism at that point of time under international community, where people move about during the World War, you know, people move about from one country to another, and therefore they have to decide, you know, a woman has to decide whether you owe allegiance to which country, or a person has to decide to whom do you owe your allegiance to. So it actually came about in a speech made by a British MP at that point of time, post-World War, to say that if a British woman marries for example, a German man, right, you know, at that point of time, they hate Germans, you know, then you have transferring your allegiance from your country, Britain, Great Britain, to the man, to your husband. And basically, that seems to suggest that women are actually chattels. Once you marry a man, that means you are the man's property, you are the man's chattel, and you have basically denaturalized your citizenship rights. So that was the idea at that time. But at this day and age, especially in the 90s, late 90s, 1995, where our country has enacted the CEDAW, you know, has enacted the CEDAW. And in 2001, we have made our commitment through an amendment to Article 8 to prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender. So the Constitution must also be interpreted at today's values, at today's society, based on today's society. And it should not be interpreted based on what could or what were the values of the past. So that essentially is our argument to say that we should basically disabuse this particular way of interpreting it. So if you want, okay, coming back to the drawing board, your question on the fact that Malaysia is still basically practicing this discriminatory law or practicing this discriminatory interpretation, I would say that it is very regrettable, you know. And the very reason, this need not go to court, actually. If the government had agreed that, you know, we are disabusing this interpretation or disabusing this practice, right? And we're going to, regardless of what the constitution says, you know, we're going to give Malaysian mothers equal citizenship rights to their children, then we actually need not go to court, right? So the reason why we could go to court is simply because this practice is still going on, and we want to get help or relief from the court to set this right. Yeah.
You hold a very unique position whereby you were counseled. So instead of other than talking about the issues, I want to talk about how did you feel seeing these mothers. See their plights when you first got the case. How long has this case been going on?
Well, it's been, I think it's been quite some time, you know, because it was back in 2020. So it's been 2 years already. And I think COVID came in, and of course, court hearings and all that were kind of stalled for a while. And that was also the height of where these problems actually came about, right? What I described to you just now, where families are being separated because of the boundaries, the close boundaries at that point of time. during the pandemic. Of course, I feel very, I was very sympathetic. I was very, very sympathetic to see these situations, especially those in which those families that have been separated, right? Where the mother and the father has been have been divorced, and that is where the crux of the problem actually arose, you know. So I felt very sad for them, you know. So I wanted to help them. So of course we won in the High Court.
I remember celebrating. I remember posting on my Instagram, reposting Federal Court decides. High Court decides.
Yeah. So we won in the High Court. That was one of the very jubilant moments where, you know, at least we got like a honeymoon period for almost a year.
There were pictures of like mothers celebrating with the children.
Yeah, celebrating, and then the children were also drawing. I mean, they drew pictures of them being a Malaysian citizen, flying the Malaysian flag and all that. So I was very moved. And of course, the decision of the Court of Appeal was very, brought much disappointment. Not just disappointment, like how, I mean, we win and we lose cases. When we lose cases, we feel disappointed. But that kind of disappointment is something which is so, it also emits some kind of helplessness. And well, we were not angry with the courts, you know. We respected the court's decision. We're not angry with the courts, but we just feel, you know, that why do Malaysian mothers have to suffer like this? And why do they even have to, in fact, after the decision was pronounced, why do they even have to go to court? Sometimes I ask myself, you know. And we come to court simply because that is our last resort, you know. The court is the last beacon of hope for the mothers. And some of them today are still suffering, you see. They still have to go to the immigration office to renew their visas in, you know, a few months time just to keep their child with them, you know. I don't know what is going to happen if they just don't renew the visa. And are they going to then bring the child to deport the child or whatnot? I don't know. But the fact that you need to go to that extent to keep your child in your own home country where you grew up, where you, you know, pride yourself in Malaysian, that is just very saddening. But of course, we are bringing it further to the federal court. The hearing of the application for leave is on the 14th of December, coming up in 2 months, exactly 2 months. So let's hope that things, you know, turn out better.
I read in an article that one of the mothers, they felt that after the judgment by the Court of Appeal, they felt like her heart was ripped by the decision of the Court of Appeal. This is just me thinking, but do you feel like personally responsible for her emotions? Like you felt like you didn't do enough, or you felt like you could have done more?
Well, as a lawyer, I feel that I've done enough. I feel that I did all I could. You know, we cited cases from around the world. You know, there was one case which we cited from Botswana. You know, where the Botswana Court of Appeal, it was a majority decision, 2-1 majority decision, which says basically dealing with the exact situation to say that you cannot imply discrimination against Botswanan women on the basis of her gender, and you must allow her to confer citizenship to a child. So we basically did our research, we covered all ends, and essentially it is a matter of opinion. So you see, in the proceedings in the High Court and the Court of Appeal, two judges agreed with us. Actually, Justice Akhtar Tahir in the High Court and Justice Nanda Balan in the Court of Appeal, two judges disagreed with us, Justice Aziza and Justice Veera Kamaluddin. So at the end of the day, if you ask me whether I feel responsible for that result, I do not think so. I think this ultimately is an opinion of the court and a divergence of views being expressed by the courts, which I think makes it ripe for consideration by the federal court, the highest court. Of course, we hope that we can get a bigger bench so that we can get more divergence of views, you know. And we do foresee that there are some judges who won't agree with us, there are some judges who would agree with us. And we just hope those who agree with us would outnumber the ones that agree with us. So, yeah. I do feel sad, of course, But at the same time, I also feel that there was, in the circumstances, nothing more that I could do. But of course, that doesn't mean that I would not try harder, you know, when we at the final tax court level.
So looking forward, going forward, you will appeal again to the federal court. And do you, and I see like you feel very excited, confident, scared, maybe?
Yeah, very excited, very, really, really looking forward to what might be, what are the points, arguments that we can actually expand in certain areas, and why basically it's a jurisprudential question at the end of the day. When we say the Court of Appeal was wrong, why was the Court of Appeal wrong? It's because the Court of Appeal should have adopted this particular way of interpreting the Constitution and not the literal dictionary way of interpreting the Constitution. So, of course, there are going to be judges who think that, you know, you should not basically stretch father to also mean mother, you know. But at the same time, we feel that, you know, basically it means parent. Parent have equal rights, father and mother. You can stretch father to mean mother. You can expand the meaning to also include mother. It's because they are parents and parents love their children, you know. Of course, you don't stretch father to mean brother or uncle or, you know, granduncle, you know, because they are not the parents. So, and especially for a mother who actually, who in fact has held the child for 9 months within her body, you know, and that nothing can be nothing can achieve a greater level of attachment, in my view, you know. In fact, I wouldn't say that, but it actually, the child most of the time is more attached to the mother than the father, you know. So what I feel is that I hope that when these arguments actually come up, the logical extent of how you actually interpret and looking at the reality of things, I do hope that the federal court will agree with to subscribe to this interpretation, this organic prismatic interpretation that we seek to convince the court.
One last question, Abraham.
Sure.
So what advice would you give to those students, especially me, like someone who want to be like you, want to be a constitutional lawyer, reported cases, want to be someone?
Well, you can get reported in when you do cases of, you can, when you do any case, you know, not just constitutional law cases, you can get reported if you do company law cases, in, you know, land law, contract law, shipping law, and so on and so forth, you know. Advice, I'm in no position to advise anyone, you know, but what I feel is that, you know, university time is very short, actually. In the blink of an eye, it'll be over. You know, you come in at the first year, when you thought, oh, it's going to be 4 years ahead. But then, in the blink of an eye, the pandemic came, you know, you sit at home, you don't even get to see your friends. Then 2 years have passed, right? And you're already in your third year. So you see, we basically must understand that you can't learn everything in university, right? Basically, you can't. What you have to do is to basically make the most out of your time in the university. Do things that you are interested, passionate at. It's okay to make mistakes at times. But of course, it's very important to basically follow up. I feel that it is very essential to go beyond your syllabus, right? The syllabus only brings you to a certain extent, to a general understanding of law, but you must basically go beyond that and try to understand the rationale of what law is. So that's on the academic side. On the non-academic side, I would feel that you should expose yourself not just to one particular basically activity. Like, for example, many of law students would want to join Mooting. Yeah, that is very commendable. I did join Mooting as well, you know, but you must also expand your skills to other areas other than law. You see, it's very important to go beyond your textbook, or rather what you are always doing so far, because when you are in practice, or when you are in the even if you are in in-house as a corporate in-house lawyer, you're going to advise your clients based on the reality of things. And most of the time, the answers will not come from the law books or the textbooks or the case laws, you see. So it is very important to also see beyond what is in what is taught as legal principles and legal concepts, and try to assimilate or rather to see the rationale behind it, and expose yourself to activities that are non-law, legal education related as well. So yep, that I think if any advice is sought, that would be the advice that I would give. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Abraham, for coming to our podcast, and
no problem, Victor. Yeah, thank you.